In 1931, George Orwell wrote and published an essay on a London spike. These were a slang term for casual workhouses, those institutions where those unable to financially support themselves could find accommodation for the night. And Orwell would use the essay as the basis of a chapter in his book Down and Out in Paris and London, and it is to this chapter of the book I turn to for today's episode. And it really does paint a vivid picture of destitution in the first half of the 20th century. Historical Crimes and Criminals podcast. I'm Steve, your host, and it's another History Bite episode. And with little ado, let's start. At about 5:45, the Irishman led me to the spike. It was a grim, smoky, yellow cube of brick standing in a corner of the workhouse grounds. With its rows of tiny barred windows and a high wall and iron gate separating it from the road, it looked very much like a prison. Already, a long queue of ragged men formed up, waiting for the gates to open. They were all kinds and ages, the youngest being a fresh-faced boy of 16, and the oldest a doubled-up, toothless mummy of 75. Some were hardened tramps, recognisable by their sticks and billies and dust-darkened faces. Some were factory hands out of work, some agricultural labourers, one a clerk in collar and tie, and two certainly imbeciles. Seen in the mass, lounging there, they were a disgusting sight. Nothing villainous or dangerous, but a graceless, mangy crew, nearly all ragged and palpably underfed. They were friendly, however, and asked no questions. Many offered me tobacco, cigarette ends, that is. We leaned up against the wall, smoking, and the tramps began talking about the spikes they'd been in recently. It appeared, from what they said, that all spikes are different, each with its peculiar merits and demerits, and it's important to know these when you're on the road. An old hand will tell you all the peculiarities of every spike in England, as at A, you're allowed to smoke, but there are bugs in the cells. At B, the beds are comfortable, but the porters are bully. At C, they let you out early in the morning, but the tea is undrinkable. At D, the officials steal your money. There are regular beaten tracks, where the spikes are within one day's march of one another. I was told that the Barnet St Albans route is the best, and they warned me to stay clear of Billericay and Chelmsford, also Ide Hill and Kent. Chelsea was said to be the most luxurious spike in England. Someone praising it said that the blankets were more like prison than the spike. Tramps go far afield in the summer, and in the winter they circle as much around the towns where it's warmer and there's more charity. But they have to keep moving, for you may not enter any one spike or any two London spikes more than once a month on pain of being confined for a week. Sometime after 6, the gates opened and we began to file in one at a time. In the yard was an office where an official entered in a ledger our names and trades and ages, also the places we were coming from and going to. This last is intended to keep check on the movement of tramps. I gave my trade as painter. I had painted watercolours, who's not? The official asked us whether we had any money, and every man said no. It's against the law to enter the spike with more than 8 pence, and any sum less than this, one's supposed to hand over at the gate. But as a rule, the tramps prefer to smuggle their money in, tying it tight in a piece of cloth so that it will not chink. Generally, they put it in a bag of tea and sugar that every tramp carries, or amongst their papers. The papers are considered sacred and are never searched. After registering at the office, we were led into the spike by an official known as the Tramp Major. His job is to supervise casuals, and he's generally a workhouse pauper. And a great bawling ruffian of a porter in a blue uniform came to treat us like cattle. The spike consisted simply of a bathroom and a lavatory, and for the rest, long double rows of stone cells, perhaps 100 cells in all. It was a bare, gloomy place of stone and whitewash, unwillingly clean, with a smell which, somehow, I had foreseen from its appearance. A smell of soft soap, J's fluid, and latrines. Cold, discouraging, prisonish smell. The porter herded us all into the passage, and then told us to come into the bathroom, 6 at a time, to be searched before bathing. The search was for money and tobacco, Rompton being one of those spikes where you can smoke once you've smuggled your tobacco in, but it would be confiscated if it's found on you. The old hands had told us that the porter never searched below the knee, so before going in, we had all hidden our tobacco in the ankles of our boots. Afterwards, whilst undressing, we slipped it into our coats, which we were allowed to keep, to serve as pillows. Fresh water was only allowed for men who were having a complete bath, so many men had to bathe in water where others had washed their feet. The porter shoved us to and fro, giving the rough side of his tongue when anybody wasted his time. When my turn came for a bath, I asked I might swill out the tub, which was streaked with dirt, before reusing it. He answered simply, "Shut your effing mouth and get on with your bath." That set the social tone of the place, and I did not speak again. When we'd finished bathing, the porter tied our clothes in bundles and gave us workhouse shirts, grey cotton things of doubtful cleanliness, like abbreviated nightgowns. We were sent along to the cells at once, and presently the porter and tramp major brought our supper across from the poorhouse. Each man's ration was a half-pound wedge of bread, smeared with margarine, and a pint of bitter, sugarless cocoa in a tin billy. Sitting on the floor, we wolfed this in 5 minutes, and at about 7 o'clock, the cell doors were locked on the outside to remain locked till 8 in the morning. Each man was allowed to sleep with his mate, the cells being intended to hold 2 men apiece. I had no mate, and was put in with another solitary man, a thin, scrubby-faced fellow with a slight squint. The cell measured 8 feet by 5 by 8 high, was made of stone, had a tiny barred window high up in the wall, and a spy hole in the door, just like the cell in a prison. In it were 6 blankets, a chamber pot, a hot water pipe, and nothing else whatever. I looked round the cell with a vague feeling that there was something missing, and then, with a shock of surprise, I realised what it was and exclaimed, "I say, damn it, where are the beds?" "Beds," said the other man, surprised. "There ain't no beds. What do you expect? This is one of those spikes where you sleep on the floor. Christ, ain't you got used to that yet?" It appeared that no beds was quite a normal condition in spikes. We rolled up our coats and pitted them against the hot water pipe and made ourselves as comfortable as we could. It grew foully stuffy and not warm enough to allow of our putting all the blankets underneath, so that we could only use one of them to soften the floor. We lay a foot apart, breathing into one another's faces, with her naked limbs constantly touching and rolling against each other when one fell asleep. One fidgeted from side to side, but it did not do much good. Whatever way one turned, it would be first a dull, numb feeling, then a sharp ache as the hardness of the floor wore through the blanket. One could sleep, but not for more than 10 minutes on end. About midnight, the other man began making homosexual attempts upon me. A nasty experience in a locked pitch cell. He was a feeble creature, and I could manage him easily, but of course, it was impossible to go back to sleep again. And for the rest of the night, we stayed awake, smoking and talking. The man told me the story of his life. He was a fitter, out of work for 3 years. He said that his wife had promptly deserted him when he'd lost his job, and he'd been so long away from women that he'd almost forgotten what they were like. Homosexuality is general amongst tramps of long standing, he said. At 8, the porter came along the passage, unlocking the doors and shouting, "All out." The doors opened, letting out a stale, fetid stink. At once, the passage was full of squalid, grey-shirted figures, each chamber pot in hand, scrambling for the bathroom. It appeared in the morning, only one tub of water was allowed for a lot of us, and when I arrived, 20 tramps had already washed their faces. I took one glance at the black scum floating on the water and went unwashed. After this, we were given a breakfast identical with the previous night's supper. Our clothes were returned to us, and we were ordered out into the yard to work. The work was peeling potatoes for the paupers' dinner, but it was mere formality to keep us occupied until the doctor came to inspect us. Most of the tramps frankly idled. The doctor turned up about 10 o'clock, and we were told to go back to our cells, strip, and wait in the passage for inspection. Naked and shivering, we lined up in the passage, and you cannot conceive what ruinous, degenerate curs we looked, standing there in the merciless morning light. A tramp's clothes are bad, but they conceal far worse things. To see him as he really is, unmitigated, you must see him naked. Black feet, hot bellies, hollow chests, sagging muscles, every kind of physical rottenness there were. Nearly everyone was undernourished, and some clearly diseased. Two men were wearing trusses, and as for the old mummy-like creature of 75, one wondered how he could possibly make his daily march. Looking at our faces, unshaven, creased from a sleepless night, you'd have thought that we were all recovering from a week and a drink. The inspection was merely designed to detect smallpox and took no notice of our general condition. A young medical student, smoking a cigarette, walked rapidly down the line, glancing us up and down and not inquiring whether any man was well or ill. When my cell companion stripped, I saw his chest was covered with a red rash. Having spent the night a few inches away from him, I fell into a panic about smallpox. The doctor, however, examined the rash and said it was merely due to undernourishment. After the inspection, we dressed and were sent into the yard, where the porter called our names over and gave us back any possessions we'd left at the office and distributed meal tickets. These were worth 6 pence each, and we were directed to coffee shops on the route we'd named the night before. It was interesting to see that a number of the tramps could not read and had to apply to myself and other scholars to decipher their tickets. The gates were opened and we dispersed immediately. How sweet the air does smell, even the air of a back street in the suburbs, after the shut-in, some fecal stench of the spike. Well, that's it for another History Bite episode. I hope you enjoyed that one. And till next time, bye-bye.